From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project gets underway at this point amid shuffling of paper and clearing of throats. This is an opportunity for a half hour of commentary and analysis and perhaps even some insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
I hope that everybody knows that when you clear your throat, it almost always means you're going to say something that is either not nice or not true.
That would be Kaylin Brown, the head of the communications department at the College of St. Rose. How be you?
Well, thank you.
Delighted
to be here with this esteemed panel.
Well, very good. And Barbara Lombardo, a longtime editor of the Saratogian in Saratoga Springs, of course, and now for teaching journalism at the University of Albany. How are you?
Good morning. Just finished my grading last night.
Oh, and how are your students this semester?
And this morning I had the flood of emails saying, is that going to round up to the next highest grade?
I remember it all too well.
Oh, dear.
You're bringing back bad memories.
Mm. Listen, word of the week. Word of the week is bleeping. See, we'll get you your opportunity to say your word of the week. The word of the week is bleep because Nicole Wallace on MSNBC, who used to be communications director of the George W. Bush White House, is now an anchor, was quoted as saying on the air after the Cohen plea and after an incident involving National Enquirer that we're about to get to, she said, "Does Donald Trump know that he's bleeped?" And the correspondent responding said, he does not know that he is bleeped, but he will find out soon. Now, of course, because it's cable TV, they are not regulated by the Federal Communications Commission, which this radio station is.
Yeah, we can't say, for example, the F word or the S word.
Wait, he didn't really say the word bleeped? She did not?
She really said the word. She said bleeped.
She did say bleep.
Yeah,
okay.
Because she can't say that word that Alan's speaking
of.
So bleep. Okay. So we have to say bleeped here. She didn't have to, but in the interest of judgment, she said it. So I think we should all talk a lot about, these bleeping stories around here. I think it's going to become the word of the week. Anyway, the story that prompted it, and we ordinarily would not have been speaking on this program over the years that we've done it about the National Enquirer, because it's not a serious news source, but my goodness, the National Enquirer now is the center of controversy about the presidency.
You and I disagree on many things, Rex, and I don't mind telling you that right here before these microphones. But one of them, of course, is that you say it's not a serious news source. I think anything that gets to that 40% of America that is supporting this president knows full well that it is a serious news source because people believe it. They read it and they believe it and it's disgusting. Nevertheless, your pomposity in saying it's not a serious news source, I think is misplaced.
Here we go. We understand that by serious, he means that not that it's credible or believable or should in any way be believed for us, that it's a terrible, terrible, terrible news source, but it's popular.
It's popular.
The reason it's terrible is because it's not a news source. It is a fictionalized accounting of Martians impregnating celebrities.
Oh, there you go.
That's what I wanted to say.
And one of them is now president. No, I didn't say that.
Sorry. Anyway, the National Enquirer sits at the end of supermarket checkout lines.
I'm fully aware
and
of that.
Individuals, good. So you've been to the supermarket. Understand how the whole swiper works and everything, unlike some of our elected officials. Excellent.
How much does a quarter million cost?
I finally figured out which end of the debit card goes where.
That's excellent. But that publication is something that the president relied on for years and years to tell his story and to promote his angle. And the beautiful, beautiful irony of this is that the man who says the press is the enemy of the people may very well be taken down by what he characterizes as the press.
Yeah, but I think your point, despite the fact that you refuse to break with your friend Rex on any intellectual issue, is so well taken here because you said so many people read it and believe it and it gets them elected. That's pretty serious stuff, isn't it?
So he's disappeared from those pages. This is what's happening with the National Enquirer. There's less Trump in the pages. There are stories saying, I think Politico wrote, that there seems to have been a breakup between the president and the National Enquirer over the last months as Cohen has turned his back on the president. And now the National Enquirer is cooperating fully with the investigation, and that's
funny
going
that
to be
works.
A problem, a bleeping problem for the president.
Yeah. So, Rex, why don't you bring everybody up to date?
Well, the president has this friend who owns the National Enquirer. What's his name?
Mr. Pecker.
Right. And
Mr. David Pecker.
Yes, of course. And he owns the tabloid, and now it seems he is cooperating on the question that Cohen claims that he worked with Mr. Pecker to set up a $150,000 payment to Karen McDougal.
You got to keep it together, Rex.
before the 2016 election. And that silenced her, basically. They bought the story from this model so that ensured that her claims of an affair with Trump would not be made public. That is, they bought her story and then squelched it.
Now, there's a name for that, I think.
Called catch and kill.
Catch and kill.
Buy the story and kill it, which is not journalism, not remotely connected to journalism, and is bogus, which explains why the National Enquirer is also bogus.
And they have explained it. Now they're telling, we did this. So the fact that they're cooperating with the prosecutors and stuff so that they don't go to jail is they are telling that they've done it not only this time, I believe, but I think they've done it before on different occasions.
The reason that I wanted to talk about this today is because I think we are looking at a spectrum of appropriate behavior in journalism these days. And on one end is this notion of paying for news. We don't do that. You know, television networks will sometimes pay a consultant, they'll call it. They'll pay a consultant fee to somebody, which is turning somebody who could be a source for a story into basically a paid.
So you don't do it ever?
No. No, we don't. People will ask us for it. You know, you're out there reporting a story and somebody's going to say, well, what do you pay me if I talk to you? And we just don't do it. Reputable news organizations
okay,
do
now,
not.
Rex, here's the question.
Sir.
What if it were the story of the century and you knew it? In other words, I once had a fight with Cuomo because, Papa Cuomo, because he said he was against the death penalty. Under no circumstances would he ever be for any death penalty case. And I said, not in the case of Adolf Eichmann. And he called me up and yelled at me for that. So I think sometimes there may be exceptions to some of these rules, no?
Well, the good news is that we don't have enough money to pay sources anymore. With the decline of the revenue stream for established journalism. But I don't know. The Adolf Eichmann point is actually pretty well taken. If there were something as significantly positive for journalism as that is.
You knew it was going to be a Pulitzer Prize. I'm just loading it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. You knew this is the story of the century. All the guy wants is a simple $5,000, and we could give him that.
That's a slippery slope, and you don't go down it. This is not a dollar value. Something is either right or wrong. Paying for news is wrong, period.
Good.
What about photographs?
I agree with you. And the reason, though, I think our listeners need to know, the reason is because people will say anything if they are paid. I will tell you anything about Michael Jackson and Graceland, right? There were maids when Michael Jackson died who went on Entertainment Tonight or on some broadcast, and they were paid big money to talk about what they knew about the pop singer Michael Jackson.
So you guys are sure, absolutely sure, that A, you wouldn't do it, which, of course, we'll never know until it happens. But also, you're sure that the Daily News and the New York Post have never done it?
I don't know about the New York Post.
Well, you said, all of you said somewhat pompously, this is not journalism, but this is not good.
But I do know that television networks have done so. For example, even the great exposés that were done about the tobacco industry 20 years ago, I believe 60 Minutes employed a whistleblower who was the consultant on the story. But what they, in effect, did was, without saying so in so many words, they paid this guy to tell his story on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, but as usual, you're pulling this Trump-like thing, deflecting the
No,
story
I'm saying
away
that
from,
I think there
I
are...
I asked you guys a direct question. Are you sure that the New York Post and the Daily News have never done it?
We can't be sure. I don't think any of us are employed there right now.
No, but it was you, college teacher, with all of your stuff that you can...
Wait, aren't you the one who wants to be called doctor? What's up with that?
Not me. Cuomo said to me on the air the other day, should I call you doctor?
Yeah, it's young.
And you
Cuomo.
Said?
I said, bleh, bleh. Well, Alan, he said.
Help me. Right, well, Alan. Yeah. And you did not say, well, Andrew. You respect.
No, by the way, that's an interesting question that you're raising. Because I think I may have asked you about it, but I know I got a lot of advice on this. You know, I know him well enough to know that he would like me to call him Andrew, I think. And I don't want to do that because I think what it does is it creates a sense of camaraderie, which I would rather not have.
Right. So you call him governor.
I do.
I think that's a good thing. I think you really do need to maintain a bit of a distance if you hope to have some independence and be able to ask those questions that you need to ask. I think that's the right choice.
Dr. Shartok started to mention about photographs and whether photographs, whether there's an exception to buying photographs.
Yeah, I did.
And I do think there's distinction because sometimes somebody is bringing to you their work and you might decide that it is newsworthy and you are willing to buy it just as you would from a freelance journalist.
Well, just for the sake of discussion, let me say I disagree with you. Because, you know, you talked about a slippery slope. People take pictures. Everybody's got a camera now, you know, a cell phone, and they take a picture and they say, okay, you won't pay me for what I can tell you about this, but I can give you a picture of it. I think there may be a little bit of a slippery slope there.
There is. You know, speaking of slippery slopes with pictures, a significant federal court ruling further limits the ability of newsrooms to use photographs on social media. Just a word of warning to journalists out there, don't you go taking photographs off somebody's Facebook page, because that material is actually copyrighted. And we find this all the time. We are often at a disadvantage because our lawyers for our company tell us, don't take those photos if you don't have permission. And we see the tabloids, speaking of the New York Post, just snatching these pictures. In the aftermath of the limousine crash in Schoharie, this terrible calamity a couple of months ago that took 20 lives in a single incident, the New York Post beat us to posting online the photographs of the victims. Not that we didn't have those photographs digitally in hand as well, but we didn't have permission to publish them. And we're not going to put ourselves in the legal jeopardy of using somebody's purloined photos.
Proving once again that lawyers will always be comfortable saying no.
Yes, it's true. It's a terrible thing. Anyway.
Unless you're Michael Cohen.
Unless you're Michael Cohen, see, although, you know, his point is at hand, and now somebody's bleeped. Mail, by the way, you can share your thoughts with us. Here's a letter from Ivan Lahara, who we spoke of last week as the new guy running the Daily Freeman in Kingston. And Ivan just wants to make the point that the Freeman newsroom is more than able to navigate and handle the challenges of our ever-evolving industry, he says, while keeping a firm foot in the mid-Hudson Valley. Offer your audience relevant local news, I dare to say, more than they can get anywhere else in the area and in the platform of their choice. So it's a good thing, he points out. They are still cooking along. And as we all note, we all, from the newsrooms that we have come from or may still be a part of, have seen numbers declining and so on. But
is this an official apology on your part?
I don't know. I don't know what we said, but Ivan wanted to say something nice about his predecessor, Tony Adamus, who's a, he says, a journalist and a mentor. So that's a wonderful thing. And we got a nice note also from somebody, Alan, you know, who is the managing editor of your hometown newspaper, the Berkshire Eagle. Well, I guess the Weekly in Great Barrington is actually your hometown paper.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
I don't like it.
I'm sorry. He's the managing editor.
I like the Eagle.
I misspoke. He is the managing editor of the Berkshire Edge.
Oh, yeah.
In your hometown.
David Scribner. No, that actually, there are three. There's the Berkshire Eagle covers the county. There's the Berkshire Record, and them I don't like, that covers the town. And then there's the Berkshire Edge, which is a completely online. And my old friend David Scribner, who used to be the editor of the Eagle, is the co-owner of that.
So the managing editor of that, Terry Cowgill, wrote a column for CT News Junkie, which is a website that covers Connecticut state government. So his guy is a bi-state, I guess, is what we would say.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a column about the Hartford Courant's recent decision to publish detailed stories around key evidence in the case of the Sandy Hook mass killer, Adam Lanza. So the state Supreme Court had to step in Connecticut, overruling a lower court, siding with the Hartford Courant, and gave out this information about Lanza. And there is a great chorus of disapproval in Connecticut about the decision by the Courant to use this information. The reaction, Terry Cowgill says, has been, how dare you sensationalize this tragedy and cause pain to the survivors just to sell papers? So it's an interesting question. I mean, here are stories resurrecting this very tragic incident in Connecticut in which the school children were slaughtered. And here are stories about the killer. The question is a newsroom justified in bringing back that pain to tell these stories?
If there's new information, and are the stories about the shooter, and he Adam Lanza?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think if there's new information, there's relevance to sharing that with readers, because according to John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham, the greatest good is served by the paper if the paper delivers new information to its readers. And the paper's obligation is to its readers, not to the families of the Sandy Hook survivors. This is not to be cold or dismissive of them. Their issues are certainly warranted, but the newspaper has an obligation to tell its readers what they've learned.
Except, Professor, that what happens here all the time is that Rex will make a decision. As the editor of a paper, shall I put this very disturbing photograph on the first page, or shall I bury it basically, you know, further back in the paper? So that's a decision, right, which is how much exposure people should get to this kind of material?
Absolutely. Just yesterday, my media ethics students presented their final group project on the limo crash in Schoharie and talked about the treatment by the media of that story, and they decided that it was okay that there was a covered body shown in one of the pictures because no one could tell who it was. They were also questioning, when is it appropriate to use Twitter and Facebook to share information about a tragedy? Is that the appropriate mechanism to do that, or does that trivialize the tragedy?
So there they are in your class. They're trying to, you know, basically make you happy and give you the right kind of answer that they think you want. However, if they're the editor of a paper and it's brand new material and it's relevant to everybody, I think this tragedy, by the way, Sandy Hook, is the worst thing that I have ever seen in my entire life. I've seen terrible things, but the slaughter of those children was absolutely the worst. And yet, I can really understand the Hartford Courant, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, this is material. If the guy was shown to be severely disturbed, I didn't really read the whole story, but I think that that's part of the thing, and that they knew it, and that leads to the whole question of mental health and to how do you stop these things from happening in the future. I think it's justified.
There is a school of thought now that people are telling us that we in the media should not even use the names of the players in mass killings, that by even saying the name of Adam Lanza, we are glorifying him and inviting copycats.
Sure.
And mental health professionals even are urging us not to do that. And I cannot subscribe to that notion. It does seem to me that our job is to find the information that we can and not necessarily tell the world everything we know, because you use your judgment with what is newsworthy and what is necessary. And ultimately, it does become a real human decision that we bring everything to it, which is why, fortunately, newspaper editors won't be replaced by computers anytime soon. But
I'm not so sure.
So I think that it was the right thing to do to publish these stories, but I understand people who say you are telling these stories because people want to read it and you're only encouraging this human impulse toward what's awful.
So where does it stop?
That really is a tough balance, because there's great curiosity to understand more about these people. There's definitely interest in understanding them, and maybe there's a good side to a story if you can understand more about the person and what happened in their life and how they got their weapons and where the system worked and didn't work, that could become a lesson for, you know, for the rest of us, for other places. That's my rose-colored glasses of trying to find the good side. We wouldn't publish it just because we can, mm-hmm. but we have some kind of justification beyond just public interest.
Right.
Well, you know, when you say we, I'm always confused by that.
I meant the good people on the panel.
as they say in baseball, nice save.
So if you want to share your thoughts with us, media@wamc.org, we would welcome that. Alan Shartok is here. That was Barbara Lombardo, who just heard, and Caitlin Brown, and I'm Rex Smith. And just one more letter from our friend Ed in Pennsylvania, who said that we all are decrying the slow decline of quality journalism And he says, on one level, I agree with you, but he says nice things about WAMC, who he listens to in Pennsylvania, and says, look at the work of efforts like the Pennsylvania Post and Texas Tribune, the work of organizations like the Lenfest Institute. These are organizations that are contributing to not-for-profit journalism, which in some instances is really thriving. He says, I submit there are even greater opportunities for higher quality journalism available today. And he notes that 77% of people are now using their smartphones for news, which is really quite something. It was just about 5 years ago that we said that only 20% of smartphone users were getting news on them. They were nowadays, boy, I certainly use my phone a lot for news, don't you?
Yeah, I do it all night long.
Yeah.
I do it, and you know, I have the sleep app, and it shows you where you're up, which hour you're up, and it's always because I'm reading the New York Times or reading your paper, Rex, the Albany Times Union, which sometimes is really eye-opening.
And is your phone now pushing alerts to you about how many hours a day you're spending on your phone?
Indeed.
Yeah. I just started getting those. It's very upsetting.
Every year, Time Magazine takes a look at Person of the Year, and this year it is interesting. The persons of the year, they said, were a group of journalists whose work has landed them in jail or cost them their lives. They included in that Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist of the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland, who were shot by a guy who was upset about their coverage and died. A pair of journalists who are imprisoned, two Reuters journalists arrested in Myanmar while investigating the massacre of the Rohingya Muslims. And the editor of the Philippine news website that is renowned for its critical coverage of the violent president there. So what Time Magazine is saying is that it is essential to recognize those who are taking great risks in pursuit of greater truth. This is Time Magazine's words for the imperfect but essential quest for facts that are central to civil discourse, for speaking up and speaking out. And I just want to say how great that is to see that, because the contrast between that and the president denouncing fake news and claiming that, what I loved was his tweet claiming that there was no smocking gun in the plea of Mr. Cohen.
You just point out that it wasn't because he was being clever, it's that he couldn't spell.
Yeah, and
it's the Covfefe syndrome.
No smocking gun. You know, the question is, what is he smocking? But
the time cover was
not enough.
Thing.
Clearly,
the time cover was wonderful.
Yeah,
it was a great choice.
We appreciate that. Right.
And it's interesting, too, that Time had previously had the current president on its cover as Man of the Year in previous times.
Well, they also had had Hitler, and they also had had Stalin. So it didn't mean that they like him. It just means that they thought that they were the great newsmakers of the year.
The biggest newsmakers of the year. And maybe the time is coming when we will not be seeing the divisions of the American people over whether they believe what's presented to them by reliable journalism organizations or not. Maybe we will get to a point where credibility will be reestablished in journalism, but it may take the downfall of the president for that to happen, as being the leading news media critic of the time. Anyway, I think we're out of time.
Oh, no.
How could that be?
This program should be an hour.
The standard refrain. So, Caitlin Brown and Barbara Lombardo are here, and Alan Shartok, and I'm Rex Smith. Thanks to our producer, David Gustina, and to you all, folks, for joining us this week on The Media Project. City desk, hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok is CEO of WAMC, columnist, commentator, and author. Rex Smith is the editor of the Times Union. Barbara Lombardo is a journalism professor at the University at Albany and former executive editor of the Saratogian and the Troy Record. And Caitlin Brown is the chair of the Department of Communication at the College of St. Rose. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org, or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.